his colloquium series at the IAM at Reims. Ulf did his master's degree at the University of Aachen in Germany, and he then worked for a while in Jülich, and he did graduate work with Richard Law and Hans Metz and got his PhD from the University of Leiden in Holland. And he then went to do a stint in Berlin at the Wissenschaftskolleg and was then asked to take over a project at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Luxembourg. And I just want to say a few words about this institute. This is actually basically a child of the Cold War, as far as I understand, in that it was an effort to bring scientists from the East and the West together in one place, and I guess Vienna was more or less an obvious place to do that. And it's actually been going on like that until now, and it's still going on like that in the sense that there are still a lot of scientists from the East. What's different now is that these guys don't pay anymore. So now it's mainly the West who pays for this research institute, but it is an international institute. And one of the reasons I want to mention this is because I want to make it clear that Canada is not paying. And that's a shame. And to make up for that, partly to make up for that, we have invited Ulf. And so we're paying a little bit. And Ulf is going to talk about one of his, I guess, one of the areas that he invests a lot of time and effort into, and that is spatial dynamics of spatially extended ecological and evolutionary systems. Ulf, please.
Yeah, thank you very much, Michael, for hosting my stay and my talk here, and thanks in particular to the hosts at the Institute of Applied Mathematics who have been so generous to bring me across the Atlantic, and it's really an honor to take part in this distinguished colloquium series. So what I would like to share with you today is some snapshot of research in spatial ecology, with some extensions to evolutionary ecology. This is very much a research area in rapid development. For the past 10 years, new methods have come up and have been extended and revised and applied to various ecological questions and various ecological models. And, of course, this talk cannot do justice to the whole breadth of what's going on in the field, but I hope to get across the kind of excitement that is permeating this field, because some progress relative to decade-old traditions in ecology and evolution are actually being made. So I've structured this talk in 6 parts. I start with a brief introduction about what it is all about to capture ecological heterogeneity and what may be promising approaches to that end. Then I briefly review the origins or the routes through which spatial complexity can actually develop in ecological systems. And I will use that insight to motivate the method that I and a few other people around the world have been working on over the past few years, called moment-based models. And then in part 4 and 5, I will apply these moment-based methods to, very briefly, unfortunately the time will not suffice to go into much depth there, to a problem of describing spatially heterogeneous ecological dynamics or population dynamics. And then I will carry on in part 5 with an application to evolutionary dynamics, which is even more demanding because the substrate of evolution is ecology, and we have to get the ecological description right if we want to get the selection pressures right. So it's kind of daunting to enter this level of describing evolutionary dynamics, but I will show that actually in some particular systems this works pretty well. And I will close with some summary and conclusions about future work. So the basic challenge in this whole endeavor is that ecological heterogeneity is truly ubiquitous at all spatial scales. So wherever we look at the continental level, at the regional level where we have ecosystems of lakes and rivers and forests, or at the very local level where individuals interact, have their territories, home ranges, forage, etc. In all these cases, the ecological world is not uniform, is not smooth, is not actually well stirred, as many mathematical models have considered in the past. So we really have to come to grips with this patchiness and the dynamical implications of non-homogeneous ecological distributions of populations. So unfortunately, most of the classical theory in ecological research, especially when you think of community ecology, but also basic principles of population ecology, do not yet account for this pervasive heterogeneity. And it will be a challenge still to be accomplished to extend some of the fundamental notions of ecological theory to in a way that makes them applicable for describing spatially extended ecosystems. Now, what has been going on in the past few decades is described by so-called mean field models. And here I just briefly introduce the notion of a mean field. This is coming from physics. Actually, it goes back to a paper by Weiss in 1906, where he described the magnetic state of a solid. And there, instead of individuals, which are distributed over ecological space, you have these little elementary magnets, which are distributed over the solid. And there, like here, the question arises, how do these magnets behave? What is their orientation? That's akin to the question what state an individual in a habitat is in. And also Weiss used certain approximations to come to grips with these systems. That also explains why we have this physical notion here, the mean field. this is indeed the magnetic or electric field initially, but has been extended by analogy to ecological systems. So the mean field assumption in ecology implies that individuals locally encounter environmental conditions according to their global average across space. So that's actually quite a simple notion. Here we have an ecological habitat. These points are individuals, and these circles are stylized ranges over which the environment is perceived by these individuals, over which they react in their vital rates to the condition of the environment. So stepping from a truly extended ecological system to a model described by the mean field assumptions simply means that we take the global average of environmental conditions and assume that all individuals simply perceive this global average, thus taking out all spatial structure of the story. So this is a drastic simplification which essentially removes all spatial complexity from the description. Now, unfortunately, this reduction is a bit too over-enthusiastic. Spatial ecology must develop a middle ground between what one may describe as intractable models and oversimplified models. These oversimplified models are what I've just described, the mean field based models, which are very convenient because essentially you get ordinary differential equations or difference equations or recursion relations for the population dynamical change. But they completely ignore, as the previous slide has shown, any spatial structure. So any effect, any implication of spatial heterogeneity cannot be captured in these classical models. Over the past decade, however, we have seen a surge of interest in individual-based models, and that came mostly, I think, because computers have become so powerful that on our desktops we can simulate ecosystems with thousands and ten thousands of individuals that are interacting in a complicated way in a spatially extended arena. It's very convenient and in some sense very satisfying to see these colorful pictures unfolding on our computer screens, but unfortunately we are often at a loss to understand what is really going on. If we throw in too much ingredients, too complex ingredients, then we really cannot dig down to the very mechanisms, very principles that are governing these dynamics. So in this sense, and also in a well-defined mathematical sense, these models are intractable. There are essentially no tools to determine equilibrium states or to even to do simple stability analysis on the basis of individual-based models. You can run them, you can look at them, but that's basically it. Now, the quest, therefore, is for this middle ground in which we do not incorporate each and every grain of spatial complexity, but instead try to capture the essential complexity, or in the notion of Richard Lewontin, we try to build a dynamically sufficient description of spatially extended ecosystems. And if we do that right, we can arrive at a tractable version of spatially structured population dynamics. So that is what I'm trying to get at. Towards the end of this talk, I will show you that sometimes these so-called movement-based models indeed manage to fill this middle ground. So let me now review what mechanisms, what pathways of interactions generate spatial complexity. And here I've tried to take apart in a kind of successive manner the departures of spatially extended ecological dynamics from the mean field assumption, from the simplifying assumptions that have underlied the simplest models of ecology. So a first and perhaps most important reason why mean field dynamics are often drastically wrong is the emergence of so-called correlation corrections. These correlation corrections arise if the average local distribution of environmental conditions around individuals differs from the average distribution around random locations. So this is illustrated in these two diagrams. Here we have a habitat, and the shades of green indicate variations, spatial variations in environmental conditions. The black circles indicate the position of individuals. Now, if you scan the whole habitat uniformly, and in this manner establish the global mean of this scalar field describing the environmental conditions, then you might arrive at something like this, homogeneous shading corresponding to the mean value. And you could also get that by looking at random locations of the habitat, and in this way establishing the average local distribution of environmental conditions. Gives the same result. It is obvious to everybody who can imagine how individuals react to their environment that they will react differently in this situation than in this situation. Here, the intensity or the degree or however whatever this environmental condition measures is very low around individuals. Here, it's very high. So obviously, we get a different response. Therefore, we get different vital rates of these individuals. Therefore, we get different population dynamical rates. And therefore, we get different attractors and different transients towards these attractors. So the correlations that may exist between the positions of individuals and the environmental conditions encountered in the environments, these are captured by these correlation corrections. And you see that these must be very important in any reasonably structured ecological dynamics. But there is a second layer to this that I have described by the notion of fluctuation corrections. In a sense, this comes through the partitioning of departures from mean field into a deterministic component and into a stochastic component. So fluctuation corrections arise if an individual's response to the average local environmental condition, and in the little diagram that's indicated by A, differs from its average response to the distribution of environmental conditions, and that's shown by B. So let me go through this figure in a bit of detail. So here we have these environmental conditions that were indicated by shades of green in the previous slide. Here this distribution describes how prevalent these conditions are in the vicinity of individuals. Now, if we simply take the average environmental condition, the mean of this distribution, and look what response individuals show to this mean environmental condition, then we get the value A. And this response function could be anything. It could be the fertility in response to the density of conspecifics. It could be a response to a predation. It could even be a mobility rate depending on, say, the local density of resources. It doesn't matter. It's just a general response in the demographic sense, demographic or behavioral sense. Now, what really happens is that the population experiences whole gamut of environmental conditions. So what we really ought to do is to average the response according to this distribution that is weighted by the frequency by which these environmental conditions occur. And here we get a different value, the value B. Why is that? If you look at the tangent of the green curve at the mean, you see that these areas which are cut off below A and above A precisely cancel. So from the first, from the zeroth order, we get A. From the first order, we get nothing, because what is actually lost here is gained there. But from the curvature of this response function, we get additional effects, and that is most obvious here, the area between the green curve and the dotted curve. That's an excess response, and we have the same on this side, between the dotted curve and the green curve. So these two excesses actually elevate the mean response of the population from A to B. And as you can see from this little reasoning, this departure from A to B only arises if these response functions are nonlinear. If you have linear response functions, there's no second order, and as I explained, the first order effect simply vanishes. So coming back to the origin of this orange distribution, it can occur for at least two reasons, following the classical dichotomy of stochastic factors in population dynamics. We can distinguish between local environmental fluctuations and local demographic fluctuations, which generate this distribution. And as I explained, once the distribution is present and we have a nonlinear response, we get a correction from A to B. And that means we get a correction from the correlation correction, which are already sitting on top of the mean field. So we have now a two-tier correction, from the mean field to the correlation corrections, from the correlation corrections to the fluctuation corrections. Once we have encompassed both, we are done and we get an accurate description of the population response. Let me give you a bit more detail on these two ways in which fluctuation corrections can arise. So as I said, the first type of fluctuation correction arises from local environmental fluctuations. This was the diagram I showed you for the correlation corrections. Here, each individual is surrounded by the average local environment experienced by all the individuals in the population. And by construction, therefore, all individuals are surrounded by the same environment. Obviously, this is not generally true. In general, the environmental conditions around individuals will differ. And this is just because of local environmental fluctuations. So here you get the variance around this mean. And if there is a nonlinear response of individuals to local environmental conditions, you get fluctuation corrections. Now, another tricky way in which such fluctuation corrections arise very generically is simply demography, simply the fact that individuals are not infinitely divisible fluids, but come in discrete parcels cannot be discretized beyond that. So a second type of fluctuation corrections arises from local demographic fluctuations. This is simply the sampling error or the sampling variance originating from the discreteness of individuals. So these fluctuation corrections are inevitable whenever discrete individuals occur in the environment and affect the vital rates. And in most population dynamical models, that's the case. So in most population dynamical models, at least if we have nonlinear responses, we get demographic fluctuation corrections. But when you look through the literature, I think it's fair to say that 99% of the models do not account for these demographic fluctuation corrections. There's a tradition from physics, again, or from chemistry, when numbers of entities are so high, 10 to the 23 individuals in a mole of matter, that you don't have to care about sampling errors. But in demography, local population sizes tend to be small, and therefore demographic fluctuation corrections come in. So even if this is the mean distribution, and now individuals are placed around the, focal population's individuals, these are the green ones around the black ones, then you see some individuals have very few neighbors, some have very many, and that's simply part of the Poisson sampling of this continuous distribution. And again, if we have nonlinear response, then the population will react differently in the two cases. So all this takes place at the local level, or at the level that may be called, in analogy to physical and chemical systems, the microscopic level. When we step up and look at the next spatial scale, our mesoscale patterns come in. And that's where it really gets messy and also very fascinating. On this slide, I've just collected for you the three most prevalent types of mesoscale patterns that have been discussed in the literature. About a decade ago, following some work by Burlist and Hocheweg, a lot of attention was focused on spiral patterns, spiral waves, spatiotemporal patterns that look like unfurling spirals. They have very exciting population dynamical properties. The only snag is that whenever we look out of the window and into reality, we do not often seem to encounter these intricate patterns. So it's a kind of pity that this exciting playground for modelers and theorists was not really matched by empirical findings for such spatiotemporal patterns. But other patterns are indeed found in nature. It is quite easy to get models to produce clusters which can move around, which can chase each other. And if you have a predator-prey system and the predator starts to nibble away on the edge of this cluster, then this prey cluster may move off and there may be a kind of chasing dynamics going on. This is more realistic when it comes to describing real ecosystems. And another dynamics which has been discussed, in fact, for decades, starting with work on partial differential equations, I would say, in the 50s, are traveling waves, which especially in epidemiology are important. And there is empirical evidence that indeed both in space and in time there are reproducible oscillations in, say, the prevalence of a disease. So if you stay put and have a disease, an epidemic passing by, you often see that the local densities are oscillating. And if you, at one moment in time, move across space, you also see such oscillations in density. Of course, it's not always so neat that we have really wave-like patterns, but because of the discreteness of individuals, they are kind of fuzzy, they may break up, and this is indicated by this picture here. The waves are discernible, but barely so. Whenever we want to describe these intricate mesoscale patterns, at the moment it turns out that we have to use special tools. So essentially for each of these different mesoscale patterns, different simplifying assumptions, different methods have to be applied in order to arrive at something like this middle ground that takes us somewhat beyond simply simulating the individual-based dynamics. So I think it's fair to say that no overarching framework has yet emerged for in one go encompassing this rich structure, this rich complexity of mesoscale patterns. So at the mesoscale, we are still pretty much at a loss. We can simulate, we can devise proprietary approximations, but there's not too much generic or generalizable or universal going on in terms of approximate dynamics. Now, departing from a list of causes or origins of spatial complexity, I would like to highlight one element that actually is very potent when it comes to generating ecological complexity. And these are cyclic interaction structures. So, mathematically speaking, these are simply intransitive invasion relations between a set of species or types or morphs, and they can result in mesoscale pattern, but they can also result in microscale patterns which are surprisingly complex and certainly worth of analysis. So the most famous example of an intransitive interaction structure is the rock-scissors-paper game. Rock destroys scissors, scissors cut paper, and paper wraps rock. So if you have A is somehow in a relation with B and B is in a relation with C, you cannot infer transitivity, and that's why they are called intransitive. And if you draw a digraph that represents this binary relation, you get a cyclic structure. So that's the motivation for calling them cyclic interaction structures. And one exciting bit here is that if you start from random interaction structures, so you set up a pool of species and you establish invasion rates between each pair of species, and then you look at the net invasion rate of each pair and construct a digraph based on this, then the question is, what is the probability that this digraph will have a cycle, a loop, or orbit, however you wish to call it? And it's very easy to show that with the number of species in this digraph going above 7, 8, 9, 10, the probability of having some cycle in this interaction graph approaches 1. It's very rapid. And I would like to illustrate this because that is one reason, I believe, why interesting non-mean field dynamics are so prevalent in nature. So I have a little simulation tool here in which 10 different species are randomly constructed. And when I mean randomly constructed, I mean that the invasion relations between them are just chosen according to some random number generator. So we get a random interaction structure. Now, what does this give us? So here at the top, you see the spatially explicit dynamics. And at the bottom, you see also spatially explicit dynamics, but with very rapid stirring, very rapid mixing of the populations. So each little square here corresponds to an individual. This is the habitat. And we can now let the population dynamics take place. You see that in the first time step, each little singleton expands to form a little patch and very quickly conquers space, so that after a few time steps, all empty space is filled up. Now, in the top graph, you see spatial structure. In the bottom graph, all spatial structure is removed through rapid stirring. So here we can now compare what implications the spatial structure has for the emerging community structure, and that is for the emerging population dynamics. So I let this run a bit more quickly now. And you see lots of patches passing through each other without actually showing distinguishable clusters, without showing too much of traveling waves, without showing spirals. So all these classical foci of research on mesoscale patterns are not needed. Here we have a pretty randomized pattern, but still it gives remarkably different results from the mean field approximation, which is actually made valid through this rapid stirring. In particular, you see that the community graph in the mean field case looks quite different from the community graph in the spatially structured case. What is most conspicuous is that the species here actually are absent down there. Also, the blue one is simply absent. So these differences are the consequence of the three mechanisms that I have described: the correlation corrections and the two types of fluctuation corrections. Now the structure has collapsed, but to a different set of species. And this is a fairly robust outcome now. If we let it run for much longer, it will roughly stay like this. And this is just qualitatively different from the mean field result. So now we can set up a new community and let it run again.
Again, what these on the right, what these colors indicate in those arcs between them?
Yeah, the colors here are cells according to species type, colored according to species type. These are the species types. These are the abundances of these species. And here you see the net invasibility relations. So here you see that cyan invades yellow, invades ochre, invades cyan. And actually, if you follow the dynamics, that's precisely what you see in space. The ochre is actually foraging or venturing into this pool of cyan individuals and is followed by yellow, which is again followed by cyan. So again, we have a qualitatively different dynamics. Not only the transient is different, also the attractor is different, and the resulting community structure is different.
I still don't understand your starting condition, because you start all with 100 for all of them. Was there any interaction with your starting conditions?
Was
like a fixed pattern, or how did you?
No, this was just random. Random Poisson process for each species.
So you just
independently
randomly and let the thing run.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can, of course, observe coexisting attractors here. So for some initial conditions, it might lock onto a different community structure after a while. But it's fairly robust. These cases are not very common. Let me show you a few more. So again, the mean field locked into dominance of a single species, and here we still have four species coexisting. Same thing. So these cyclic interaction structures actually are selected by the local spatial interactions that are occurring in the ecosystem. So even starting out from a completely randomized set of interactions, what prevails in the end are these cyclic interaction structures, and they then cause the massive departures from the mean field through these correlation corrections. I mean, the correlation corrections simply mean that in the vicinity of the red, you will find a lot of orange, which is pursuing the red is pursuing the orange is pursuing the cyan, the cyan is again pursuing the red. So we get a lot of non-randomness in the local environments of individuals. You also see actually that the mean field is often oscillating vigorously, and for those of you familiar with the mathematical analysis, these are often heteroclinic cycles, which are taking off from the interior of the phase space and extending oscillations towards the boundaries until the trajectory gets so close to one of the boundary planes that the species goes extinct. So what gives heteroclinic cycles in the mean field gives actually persistence and coexistence of several species in the locally interacting community. So again, you saw the rapid oscillations in the mean field, and also quite a frenzy in the structured model. But still, we find that this tripartite community structure emerges very reliably. So from all these random graphs that I select and start out with, a lot for this model, perhaps some 60 or 70 or 80%, end up in a tripartite structure, which actually gives rise to very vigorous non-equilibrium spatial temporal dynamics.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
If you look at one point in the top graph, it seems like you'd get a cyclic pattern.
Yeah.
And in the bottom, you have a cyclic pattern just at the beginning before it settles down.
Yeah.
So they seem to be pretty close. But what's really the difference that makes it stable at the top?
Well, what makes it stable at the top is that each little patch is isolated by distance from other patches. So since these oscillations then are not occurring in synchrony, these types can persist and coexist in the spatially structured graph. But since the global coupling, the rapid stirring, enforces synchrony in the mean field model, they touch on the boundary planes and result in the collapse of the community.
Could you just modify the mean field just a little bit so that you get the cyclic, the persistent cyclic?
Not really, no. No, you need to take account of these local interactions. That's the only way to reflect what's going on.
If you start with more species in the beginning, is it more likely that you'll have a community of four or five emerging?
Indeed. Yes. So actually, individual-based models are very nice. In this regard, you can simply scale up the number of species without computational cost. So I ran this with 100 species, 200 species, and then indeed you get structures which contain 10, 15 species. They still have a skeleton of intransitive interactions, but there's some kind of neutrality also around this skeleton. Okay, so after giving you some glimpse of what spatially structured population dynamics can result in a very different manner from mean field dynamics, let's now briefly review what tools are available for capturing the essential complexity in these spatially structured systems. So one approach that I will focus on is based on looking at spatial moments. These are actually very simple objects the first moment of a species is simply the density or the abundance of individuals, traditionally called N in ecology. Now, when you look at the density of pairs, they come in different kinds depending on how the connecting vector between the two pairs is oriented and what length it has. So the density of pairs is contingent upon this vector, and only in isotropic systems in which there is no pronounced direction in the environment, for example, through a physical gradient running downhill or from prevalent wind direction or something like that. Usually we have this isotropy, and therefore only the distance matters, but not the orientation of this arrow. So we can determine from a spatial pattern the density of pairs at a given distance, and that is the primary object on which these moment-based methods are operating. And we can continue in a complete analogy and look at the density of triplets. And now we have to specify two vectors. And even if we are in an isotropic case, this means that we can rotate this little triangle that connects the three individuals. But still we need three lengths to specify the shape of the triangle. So triplet densities are already something quite complex. It's a density in a three-dimensional space for each species. Obviously, you can apply these notions to spatially continuous systems in discrete space models. The locations here are simply constrained to the grid points of your lattice. So operationally, if you imagine you have some field data, for example, some tree count in which you have measured the location of each stem, then how would you measure the pair densities? Well, it's fairly straightforward. You actually choose a focal individual, you choose your distance vector, and you choose a little rectangle that has its corner at the end of the distance vector. So this d xi 1 and d xi 2 are small quantities. And then you count the number of other individuals that fall into this rectangle, and you repeat this count by scanning over all focal individuals. And then you plot the resulting density as a function of the two components of this vector. And for this pattern here, that gives us a distribution like that, where at the origin, so for very small distances, we get a peak, and around that we essentially get some noise. Now, as I said, most of the time we have isotropic patterns. So instead of looking at the length and the orientation of this arrow, we can just look at the length. So again, we choose focal individuals, we choose the length of this radius, we choose a thickness of this ring, called dr here, and we count the number of individuals that fall in the ring, and we repeat this count by moving this ring onto each focal individual being in its center. And then we plot the number of individuals that fall into the gray area as a function of the diameter of the ring. So that brings out the same structure here, it's the same pattern, a bit more clearly. At small distances, the pattern has more pairs than you would expect under the assumption of complete spatial randomness, which is actually corresponding here to the value of 1. At intermediate radii, there's a deficit of pairs, and at long radii, the density of pairs returns to what you would expect under the mean field assumption. That is always the case unless you have some macroscopic structure in your pattern. So you have a departure at the microscopic scale, but eventually for long radii you return to the mean field expectation. So it's really quite doable if you have such grid-based data or continuous space data to calculate these pair densities. There's a little piece of trivia that I find interesting to mention in this context. a behavioral psychologist in 1975 has done some experiments about our perceptual aptitude in picking up correlation structures. And it's quite easy actually to do the test yourself. In this square, we have a certain pair density and we have a certain singlet density. And across this line, the singlet density has been kept the same, but the pair density has changed. Or in other words, the second order correlations between these gray scale values has been changed. And I think we all see this difference quite clearly. These are not the same kinds of pattern. However, if the singlet density and the pair density are maintained across the divide, and the difference is introduced into the triplet density, so creating an order 3 difference, at least I find it impossible actually to detect a difference here. So our eyes, our perceptual apparatus is really good in picking up correlation order 2, but it's miserable at detecting correlation order 3. So that's of course no argument in a mathematical model what our mind can do, but it's perhaps helpful to realize that the triplet densities are very hard to pick out except if you do it numerically and very accurately through the statistics. Now there's one nasty thing about moment-based models, and that is cropping up. Whatever ecological system you analyze, it's a moment hierarchy. When you write down the dynamics of the singlet density, you find that it depends on the pair density. When you then write down the dynamics of the pair density, it depends on the triplet density, and so on. So the dynamics of the triplet density depends on the fourth moment. So this is not a closed dynamical system. To make it closed, we have to truncate the moment hierarchy. And classical ecology truncates this hierarchy after order 1, simply retaining the mean field dynamics in terms of abundances. The new moment-based models truncate after order 2 and therefore retain as part of the dynamical description the pair densities dynamics. And as you can imagine, that essentially covers many interesting aspects of spatial heterogeneity. So this is just repeated on this slide. Moment-based models extend classical non-spatial models by tracing through time the second spatial moment in addition to the first one. And these moment-based models require a so-called moment closure to truncate the moment hierarchy by expressing the third spatial moment through the first and second one. And that is an area of quite active, if rather small-scale research at the moment. What moment closures should be chosen? I can't go into this in any depth, although it's probably the most exciting bit in the whole story. In discrete space, a group of Japanese population ecologists have transferred some results or some methods that were developed in theoretical physics already in the 1950s by Bogolyubov and some others to theoretical ecology, and they have used this expression that links the triplet density to the pair and singlet densities. A group in Princeton has used a different expression for how the triplet density depends on these other quantities, and also myself and Richard Law, we have looked at yet another somewhat simpler expression to do the same job. The dynamics are not critically dependent on which moment closures you choose, but the numerical accuracy of what you actually get, of course, varies with the moment closure. So now I want to go quite briefly through two examples, one focusing on the ecological dynamics, near population dynamical level, and the other focusing on evolutionary dynamics. So, just to recap, individual-based models in continuous space are based on three fundamental processes: the birth event, the death event, and the movement event. In a birth event, the fertility of an individual is affected by the density of conspecifics or heterospecifics in its local environment, and it results in the production of one extra individual at a certain distance. A death event is simply the removal of individual, again depending on the density of conspecifics and heterospecifics in its local environment. And the same is true for a movement event where the individual does not die but move off to a slightly different distance. All these radial dependencies are determined by kernels, and these kernels therefore embody the ecological structure that is present in the dynamics. Our models in discrete space can be again defined quite analogously. So the example that I want to give you is based on the well-known competition colonization trade-off. Here you have two species in continuous space, red individuals, blue individuals. The red species is the better competitor, but the poorer disperser. So it is not so agile and not so likely to move off to different places. The blue individual is a weaker competitor, so in comparison with the red ones, it is more likely to die if surrounded by red ones than vice versa, but it is a better disperser. If you run the system for some time, you see that there's some self-thinning. You see that the red individuals are getting somewhat clustered, and if you really pay close attention, you see that where there are red individuals, there are usually few blue individuals and vice versa. So we can quantify this visual impression through measuring the pair densities. So here you see, as a function of distance, the pair densities for conspecific red pairs, for conspecific blue pairs, and for heterospecific pairs. So the red species shows a strong aggregation, a strong overrepresentation of pairs at small distance. The blue species does not show any much spatial structure, that's essentially noise. Whereas between the red and the blue species, we see a segregation at small distances. There are fewer small distance pairs than there should be if the patterns were random. So this has tremendous consequences for the dynamics that we see developing in this system. Here we see the abundances in the red species, the abundance in the blue species. We have 16 initial conditions from which we start the system with random patterns, and we see that all of these trajectories converge to this point in phase space, which corresponds to the winning of the weaker competitor and better disperser. So the individual-based simulations tell us that competition is not all that matters. Also, being good at colonization can save you. And that's what we see here. Running the same system through the mean field assumption gives you a very different phase portrait, and the mean field assumption predicts exclusion of the blue species and the winning of the red species. And our moment-based methods finally give results that are in remarkably close correspondence to those of the individual-based system. So by tracing through time the singlet density and the two singlet densities and the three pair densities, we capture the essential complexity, spatial complexity in the system, and arrive at accurate predictions. So we do not need all the higher moments that are, of course, part of the pattern. Only tracing the pair densities suffices. The second example is from evolutionary dynamics, and as I said, that's somewhat more demanding because you really have to get the population dynamical level right before selection pressures come out correctly. Here we have looked at the evolutionary dynamics on a random contact network, which is often used as a stylized substrate for social interactions. Here, the nodes of the graph are the sites of possible individuals, and the filled sites are indicated in color. Here, green, red, blue. Green, yellow, red. And looking at this focal individual in yellow, It is surrounded by two green ones and one red one and one empty side. And these colors indicate the level of altruism or sociality extended by these partners on the network. So we are interested in looking at the joint evolution of this sociality and the mobility by which individuals move across this random graph. So this red, this yellow individual receives altruistic support or cooperative support by the two green individuals. It receives nothing from the empty side, and it receives nothing from the filled but uncooperative partner on the other neighboring side. So the system is really very simple. We just consider these two traits, the level of social investment and the rate of movement across this random graph. Social investment comes at a cost. The more you invest into your partners, the steeper the cost increases. We also have looked at other cost-benefit relations. And mobility simply comes at a linear cost to keep matters simple. So social investment benefits the fecundity of receiving neighbors, but it comes at an accelerating cost to the donor. And now we can again compare the outcomes of the three modes of describing the dynamics. Here we have the individual-based evolutionary dynamics. So now we look at trajectory in the trait space, the two-dimensional trait space of this population, the mobility rate and the investment into partners, and the yellow trajectories again show how in the course of time these traits change when you introduce small mutations that produce variants on which selection can act. The green lines are isoclines, evolutionary isoclines, and the red dot is an evolutionary attractor. So here we move towards this attractor from all sides. It's a global evolutionary attractor. And these isoclines actually are already based on the moment-based dynamics. Here we see the vector field taking us to this global evolutionary attractor. And you see by comparing the position of the cluster here to the predicted location of the evolutionary attractor that we obtain a surprisingly good accuracy. This is not as good for all parameter combinations that you might want to look at. That's why I keep stressing that describing evolutionary dynamics in spatial systems is one level more demanding than describing population dynamics accurately. Here the correspondence is very good. Just to highlight, the mean field predictions would be no mobility, no sociality, and that's just drastically wrong and qualitatively in error. So again, the moment-based dynamics does a pretty good job in capturing the essentials of these dynamics. And thus I come to the summary of the talk. We have available now a suite of alternative frameworks for looking at spatially structured ecological dynamics. In the beginning of the talk, I have highlighted three dimensions or three mechanisms, origins, through which spatial complexity can operate: the correlation corrections, the fluctuation corrections, and at the mesoscale level, these intricate spatiotemporal patterns of spirals, clusters, and traveling waves. Now, the master models are always the individual-based ones. That's what we believe is closest to reality. That's where we can incorporate most complexity on the ecological side. So these individual-based models, be they continuous space or discrete space, can capture and generate all these three dynamical features. It is noteworthy, however, that the classical framework for describing spatially structured populations, partial differential equations, are really very good at predicting mesoscale patterns, but do not consider local correlations and local fluctuations. And the reason for that is simple. They are derived as a limit from individual-based models by assuming two things. First, that the local population size goes to infinity. That takes out the fluctuations. And second, assuming rapid local stirring. This is not rapid global stirring, but only locally all correlation corrections are destroyed. By contrast, we have looked at spatially implicit models, and we have looked at the pair approximation, which is good for discrete space, and at correlation dynamics, which have been developed for continuous space. And they can capture the correlation corrections. That's actually what they are mainly meant to do, and they can also incorporate the fluctuation corrections. They are no good at capturing mesoscale patterns, although if there is some modest degree of mesoscale patterns, they still give pretty accurate results. But as soon as you get really full-blown spirals, full-blown clusters, they fail quite miserably. Just brief mention, Steve Elner has developed what he called a pair edge approximation, and that is essentially meant to carry over one of the virtues of partial differential equations, namely describing traveling waves, to the world of correlation corrections and fluctuation corrections. So in a limited sense, the correlation corrections and fluctuation corrections can be captured for a limited type of mesoscale patterns, namely traveling waves. And finally, the non-spatial or mean field models are missing the boat on all these three dimensions of spatial complexity. So in this talk, I've tried to show that spatial complexity can originate from microscale and from mesoscale dynamics. At the mesoscale, we have most prominently spirals, clusters, and traveling waves. And as I've tried to explain, they all require their particular set of special tools. One set of tools for spirals, another set for clusters, another for traveling waves. But there's not yet any commonality or uniformity emerging between the treatment of these mesoscale patterns. The situation looks different at the microscale, where we have identified local correlations and fluctuations as the origins of spatial complexity, and both of them can be treated in a canonic or generic manner by these moment-based models. So in that sense, these models promise to establish the long-sought middle ground between the intractability of individual-based models and the oversimplification of mean field models. Should you be interested in more on this topic, there is a book which came out 2 years ago on simplifying spatial complexity, and if anybody would like to know more about this, please ask me after the talk. So, thank you very much for your attention.
So, I think that time for a few questions. Go ahead and take them.
Yes, please.
The moment-based method you mentioned, they reminded me a lot of methods we use for liquids. Like, are some of the closures you try also similar, like the Kirkus-Yeri?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's where this all comes from. And it's actually remarkable that it took theoretical ecology some 3 decades to make the transfer from the knowledge in physics. One of the closures, which is quite prevalent in the physical literature, the so-called Kirkwood closure, is not actually doing very well when we compare it to actual ecological dynamics. So it was not even on my sheet. We have tried it out, and we think that better closures exist for these ecological dynamics. So physics even has moved towards fourth-order closures, as you probably know very well. So truncating the hierarchy after the third level, which is incredibly demanding, and we haven't even tried to do that in the ecological context. Yes, please.
I have a fair amount of experience of using partial differential equations for developmental biology, the reaction diffusion equations and things like that. And one is often dealing with probably very low concentration, so that in fact you may be dealing with only thousands of molecules, just as you're dealing with thousands of animals or plants in a region.
Yeah.
And I found it's fairly easy to throw fluctuations in just by using a Poisson distribution on these things, and it works fine to put fluctuations.
Yeah, that's a good point. You can extend the reaction diffusion equations to include fluctuations. Yeah. I have not seen extensions to include correlation corrections, and I think that's pretty hard because the local stirring removes them for good.
Yeah. Hmm? Yes, I was only thinking of fluctuations.
Hmm? Right. Hmm. Yes, please.
One of the biggest problems in ecology, as I see, rather than ecology, is model validation. And it seems to me that these moment-based models are just another group of models which are not validated, you know, in a sense. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I mean, the aim is certainly an honorable one, and the practical achievements are, I think, very hard to come by. I'm working with some people from forest ecology, and at least for them, it makes a lot of sense to speak of these interaction and movement kernels. So that's a kind of natural way of capturing their data. There's been a paper in Science, I believe, 2 years ago, in which for tropical forests, these pair densities actually were reported. So as far as the expression of actual patterns in terms of these descriptive statistics is concerned, I think these are really very versatile. Expressing interaction kernels or estimating interaction kernels from data is a hard task. And the idea is that you can probably do so with transplant experiments, some overshading experiments in plant ecology. But in forest ecology, you would have to extract these functional parameters by fitting the model. So there are no independent experiments you can do with the long-term dynamics in forest ecology. I mean, we just have to go beyond the mean field. And even sometimes for some populations, validating the mean field and measuring an interaction matrix, if we have several species, is a tough task. So I sympathize with your request that this must be a step, but I think it is a step that will take some 10 years to develop adequately. Yes? Yep.
I just wondered, is the line between spatially explicit and spatially implicit a clear line, or is there some fuzziness?
As far as I know and understand, it is clear cut. Either you have the spatial dimension as an argument to your state variable or not.
So you said your talk was all on spatial implicit.
Well, the moment-based models I talked about were all spatially implicit. I mean, what you trace through time in a moment-based model is the global density of each species concerned and the pair densities. So the pair densities carries no information whatsoever where an individual is located. It is an average over all individuals, and it just carries information about average neighbors.
That's where I got confused a bit, because density to me implied some kind of an aerial or distance.
Yeah.
Spatial.
Yes. You divide by area. You count the number of pairs, say at 10 meters distance, and then once you have done that in a whole plot, you divide by the area of the plot. That's why it's called a pair density. Yeah, it's just a way to rescale and to remove the dependence on the system size. Yes, please.
Do these moment-based models predict the interaction structures that you...
No, they're not meant to predict them. I mean, you could actually try to use them to simulate such extended community dynamics and see whether indeed these cyclic interaction structures are selected out through the local interactions. I think nobody has tried to do that yet. Yes, please.
Sort of a general question. I mean, there's lots of things that you maintain sort of these local correlations.
Yeah.
How should we go about, in theory and data together, to sort of characterize the processes that maintain them, you know, between behavior and habitat? Is there any kind of formal way of doing that?
Yeah. What kind of processes, in addition to dependencies of the vital rates, would you be thinking of?
Well,
behavioral processes?
Many things in individual-based models.
Yeah. Yeah. You see, I mean, that's something where I think the hope for some universal approximation will not come true. I mean, as soon as your individuals are endowed with a fairly intricate, intrinsic life, like a finite state automaton to have a formal representation, this is no good. I mean, these individuals must have a very simple internal state, and they must react to their environment in a way that is essentially defined by abundance of conspecific and heterospecific and by distance. I think we have to conclude the same as for mesoscale patterns. We would need an individual approximation approach probably for many of these behavioral systems separately.
So using both, you know, say you have a model, a moment-based model, an IBM.
Yeah.
I guess if you have these distributions, you can do some sort of important sampling and get predictions relative to your individual-based model.
Yes.
How would you go from an individual-based model conforming, picking out the relevant detail related to moments?
Well, these moment-based models, in a sense, assume this in the form of kernels. I mean, this is a relevant detail.
But it's
like,
only distance orientation.
Yes.
What does it say about behavior?
I think it would not try to say much about behavior just because it's too complex to incorporate. I mean, it's an interesting and exciting extension. Perhaps if one restricts attention to a single species, one would be able to do something in the sense of complicated I states of individuals that change through interaction with their surroundings. I wouldn't exclude it, but I've seen no work in that direction yet.
Something you could actually measure.
Is there anything in your work about things like climatic factors that are over your whole area but can fluctuate from year to year, like some plants won't tolerate temperatures below freezing, and if that happens once in 10 years,
yeah.
They're gone.
Yeah.
Kind of thinking.
Yeah, I haven't worked on this, but I mean, this is something one can incorporate actually without problems into these moment-based methods. It is really just an external driving force onto the parameters. That would be feasible. I mean, as soon as you then have an ergodic environment, which unfortunately I think on the timescales we're interested in conservation concerns we don't always have, but if you assume an ergodic environment, you could even derive some stuff analytically.
Okay, I think this is a good point to come to an end. I want to mention two more things. One is that if Holt is going to be around for some time here, if you want to talk to him, just let me know. That's probably the best way to get in touch with him. The other is, if anybody wants to join us for dinner tonight, they should tell me right now. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.